So it's 2 minutes past the top of the hour, and while I see the number of participants still rising, I'm going to go ahead and start this webinar. So foremost, I want to thank everybody for joining us today. I'm Tom Lee. I'm one of the co-founders and head of research for Fundstrat Global Advisors. Our firm is an independent macro research firm. And we have joining us Dr. Christopher Murray from the Institute for Health Metrics, IHME, and he's the director and chair in Department of Health, but he's got a great background. I'm not even gonna do it justice. You gotta check out his bio on the website, okay? So he is chair and professor of health metrics and sciences at the University of Washington. He's the founder of the Global Burden of Disease, okay? He's got a storied history in science. I mean, just massive history, including working at the WHO. He's authored 16 books, 420 journal articles. He's based in Seattle. And sorry, I've probably left out a lot of great details. And before turning it over to Dr. Marine, I wanted to sort of set this discussion. So 2020, as you know, has been a year that many of us won't see again for many lifetimes. And the reason it's so unusual is we've had a global depression, one that, based on unemployment, was worse than the Great Depression. So something that's worse than what we saw in 1929. And as you know, 1929 and the depression is like in every history book. So we're living a history that many of us thought would never happen, and our ancestors probably thought would never happen again. And it's a year where the Federal Reserve basically ripped up its playbook and has decided to go long and low forever. We're talking, multiple years where they're expecting rates to be zero. That is an incredible change in their strategy. And we saw the fastest ever stock market decline in history. And this is all because of a single factor, which is the COVID-19 pandemic. So for those who don't know how important COVID is either to markets or to their own life, they're massively underestimating it because it's been the single most important effect on markets this year. Without question, it's going to be a single most important factor on markets for the next 12 months, because until this disease is vanquished or understood, we face a lot of macro risk. So that's why I was quite excited to have Dr. Murray here, because he's developed some forecasts that I've found extremely useful since the pandemic started. So it's been sort of central to how we view the path of this. And there's a lot of uncertainty because in the next couple of months, we're entering flu season. And as you know, flu season is a time when a lot of viruses start to spread and our immune system isn't as strong. So I'm setting this up and I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Murray.
Thanks, Tom, and pleasure to be here. Let me move to the slides. And what I'm going to try to do is walk you through a little bit of the background of how do we model COVID and some of the uncertainties about the future. So let me start with just how big is the problem. So this week, globally, COVID is the sixth leading cause of death in the world. And here in the United States, it's still, despite recent declines, it's the second leading cause of death. And in Europe, it's the eighth leading cause of death. So that's context that it's a big cause of illness, even compared to, mainstream killers like heart attacks. Now, we started modeling at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation COVID in early March, primarily to serve hospital systems, our own and others, to forecast when the peak would occur. And so they could plan for ventilators, ICU beds, staffing rotations. We got the peak pretty accurately, but after the peak, we started to get lots and lots of requests for longer range forecasts from governments, from business, from others. And we switched over to a model that was not a statistical fit, which is what we used to estimate the peak, but a classic transmission dynamics model. and it was a sort of statistical hybrid. So we're capturing what drives the transmission dynamics through a multivariate statistical analysis of what are the covariates or predictors of transmission in each place, each state, each country by day. And then we've made further tweaks. We continue to tinker with the model, as you might guess, on a weekly basis. But since about June, we've been running with essentially the same model framework. And I'll walk you through what drives the results. Now, perhaps the most important thing about making sense of the pandemic and why there's a lot of confused information out there is the which data do you trust? And we trust mostly for getting the evolution of the epidemic right death data, because when tests are not widely available, as they weren't in April and May and still in some places, they are preferentially given to the sickest patients in hospital. And so while there's lots of problems with death data, it's way better than case data, which is very sensitive to how much testing you do. And we saw, exaggerated surges in case numbers that were reflected real increases, but were not as bad as the case numbers would suggest, like Florida in July, where cases went up tenfold, but probably transmission only went up twofold. The other types of data that we try to use is hospital admissions and hospital census counts. Those are also better than case reports because, again, there's a certain threshold of severity to get into hospital, and so it's probably a better marker of what's occurring. Now, to give you an idea of just how much, figuring out the signal compared to the noise is a challenge, here's a plot for Florida. Bottom left is daily deaths. Middle on the bottom is daily cases. And on the right is hospital. You can see that 10x increase in cases that occurred late in the summer, but only about a 2x increase or 2.5 for hospital admissions and about a 2x increase for deaths. And we try to extract that signal from all of these types of series, and that's what goes into how we fit the transmission dynamics model. Now, one of the big debates in terms of COVID and the one that will dictate the economic consequences in the future is the role of social distancing mandates. So on the left is a global view by region in the world of the average number of social distancing mandates that governments put in place. And we track 7 now. So that's school closures, partial business closures, full, non-essential business closures, stay-at-home orders, large group gathering restrictions, travel bans, and now mask mandates, as we've learned that masks are actually pretty important. And on the right is cell phone-based mobility data. We analyze data from Google, from Facebook, from Safegraph, from Descartes Lab, and Apple. And we put them all together to get a comprehensive view of how much people are moving around. And when countries put on the mandates, mobility crashed pretty much everywhere in the world, even places without an epidemic. And then we've seen variable responses through April, May, and June of increasing mobility, and it's held pretty constant, with important country variation since then. And we use the mandates and the mobility data as a key input into our model. Now, one of the things that we've observed, which makes modeling this really tricky and makes the future very hard to really be sure about, is that there's a phenomenon where when things get better, people start taking greater risk. They stop wearing their mask, they have more interaction, they'll go to a bar, they'll have indoor dining. And that, so we see a place like Israel on the bottom left, they put in place the mandates, they brought the epidemic under control at a very low per capita death rate, and then started to relax, and now we're seeing a steady increase in the epidemic. Cases are really surging, deaths are also starting to take up. Classic example where cases go up more than deaths, because now Israel's testing more than they were early in the summer. But still, this roller coaster, and we'll expect Israel to peak soon as people get really concerned and more careful, come down, and then start going back up again. Madrid, which had one of the biggest epidemics early on and one of the highest death rates per capita to on the top, you can see deaths where it went way up, like New York City, came crashing down. And now, with the surge that seems to be related to seasonality, more about that coming, we're seeing cases shoot up, hospitalizations go up, and deaths are finally starting to go up again. So we're seeing, and from what we anecdotally hear, the behavioral response in Europe has been to the point where lots and lots of people in Europe think the epidemic's over, and we're seeing, you know, particularly in younger groups, really at-risk behavior, and that's fueling transmission, and now we're seeing deaths going up as well. So a more global view of mobility, the places in dark blue are the places where mobility compared to pre-COVID baseline is still quite reduced. So it's parts of Latin America with big epidemics, parts of Central America, California is still pretty reduced, and then mostly India. And the rest of the world, unfortunately, has crept back up to near pre-COVID baselines for mobility, which is a bad omen for what's to come later this year. Another thing that we, you know, in the medical community, we were pretty skeptical of masks, including myself, back in February and March. But as the evidence accumulated, both in terms of individual level studies and the protective effect of masks is quite considerable, probably 40% if you wear a mask, reduction of risk. And at the population level, we consistently find that mask wearing is very predictive of disease transmission. And so it's an integral part of our model and also opens up a strategy for state and national governments to put in place mask mandates. Now, there's some really interesting sociocultural gradients in mask wearing. You know, in Europe, north-south gradient, northern Europe, they don't like to wear masks. Southern Europe, they're wearing masks. All of Latin America, pretty high mask use. And interestingly, India has high mask use. And in the US, it's the states that have had big epidemics, Northeast, Florida, Texas, California, that have the highest mask use right now. Now, probably the most important for you thinking about the markets is seasonality. And it's the one thing that many modeling groups do not include in their model. Not because I think people have not thought about seasonality, because almost all respiratory viruses are seasonal, but I think they just haven't thought about ways to include it. We've investigated many ways to include seasonality. And when we started out, we had temperature in our model. And then we found that by looking back in the data at weekly deaths from pneumonia and creating that index variable based on the weekly death rate from pneumonia, that turned out to be very predictive in our data, you know, our regression analysis of transmission. And that stayed in the model and has maintained its coefficient over the summer as we rerun the models every few days. And this is just a map showing what you would expect based on pneumonia seasonality to be the ratio of death in February to death in August. February being the peak for pneumonia, August being the trough. And, you know, the difference there is large. It's 80% in the north and it's, you know, the reverse down in the southern hemisphere, with not much difference, you know, in the tropics. Okay, our basic model for those who are model junkies is a classic transmission dynamics model where we use differential equations to track the progression from being susceptible to exposed to infected but not infectious to being infected and infectious and then recovered. And the key thing here is that we have the transmission parameter, that is the likelihood of moving out of the susceptible box, is a function of the covariates I talked about, mask use, testing per capita, mobility, and a series of other variables that we've also found some relationships like air pollution, altitude, population density. But the key thing, of course, for modeling this is the time-varying covariates, and those are, as mentioned, mask use, testing, mobility, as the most important of the time-varying covariates. Now, we also have lots of unexplained components in the model. And so we capture that with using the residuals, or if you want to think of it as a random effect for each location in our models running forward. But we use only the last 28 days of what makes a place exceptional and run that into the future. And that's based on quite extensive out of sample predictive validity testing that which we do, you know, every week or two to make to tweak where the model it will be have the best performance. Now, if you're in the audience, you're probably asking, well, why should you pay any attention to our model? It's a great question. And so what we do is we take all the publicly archived models, so you can go back and compare their prediction to what happened and compare performance. And the interesting thing is, and here's the US nationally, and you can see all the different predictions that people make, our models in green there on the far right. And you find out that actually models are not that bad. We're pretty good, and I'll come back to why they're diverging now, but they're not so bad. And in fact, if you add up performance, our model is the best, but there's other models that are pretty decent. And at 10 weeks, we have a median error of about 20%. So that's probably better than I would have guessed these models would be. Now, one set of models from Imperial in the UK is particularly poor, and they have about a 550% error. But the Los Alamos National Labs only run out 6 weeks. But while they do a rather good job. And in the long range models, you know, there's a number of models that are in the 20 to 30% range. So generally speaking, these models are doing a better job than I think some people in the public perceive. Okay, where are we in the US? Or I mean, in the globe first and then the US. So globally, you might have noticed in the media that cases have been sort of flat for the last 6 weeks with deaths slightly trending down. But of course, that's masking completely different patterns with Europe surging, Latin America on the downswing, and India surging right now. And the US had a downswing from August down till recently, but now cases, as we predict, are starting to turn around, and we expect deaths to follow soon. Okay. Now, we, in our base models out to January, we do run for certain groups, sort of on a more private basis. We do run models out much longer range. So there's some businesses that are interested in very longer range forecasts. Of course, the uncertainty gets very large, but at least for the publicly available models out to January, we have a view that things are going to get much worse. And primarily two things drive that. That phenomenon I showed you in Israel, where people, when things start going down, they start being less careful. So you get, you know, enhanced transmission. And concerns about economic impacts mean governments are very reluctant to reimpose mandates. And then seasonality in the Northern Hemisphere. So the blue line is what we think is most likely to occur globally. The orange line is what could occur if governments did nothing when things got really bad, which we don't think will be the case. And the green line is what could occur if we could get everybody in the world to wear a mask like they do in Singapore, which is 95% of people when they leave the home. So a huge variation depending on how individuals respond and governments respond. For the US, we see, you know, you see the original hump and the summer hump in the middle there, and we see things getting worse than April in December. Now, in reality, I think that the timing of that big peak could be January as well as December. And it's driven to a large extent by, you know, what happens in the next month in different places and when the epidemic turns will tell us more about when that peak will occur. The key point, though, is that on current trajectory, we expect a major winter surge, which will be worse than the April surge in the country. Now, depending on each state, it's of course different because of a number of factors. In Europe, we also expect things to be worse than they were in April. And as unlike the US, that uptick has already started in Europe with deaths already heading up, as well as cases have been surging for quite a while. Okay, so a few reflections to round this out, and then we'll have questions. A question I get all the time isn't the forecast for the future going to be affected by the fact that treatment's getting better? And every clinician I know who treats COVID patients will tell you that treatment is better, at least in the better hospitals. We've learned how to ventilate patients better. There's dexamethasone treatment and remdesivir. Now, you would have thought this would then be easy to find in the data evidence that treatment is having a big impact, but try as we might, we can't. And to round out two types of evidence, one is we can look with lots of data from every state or almost every state at the admission fatality rate of the people who get to hospital, what fraction die. That has remained remarkably constant at the national level over time, not going down. And the infection fatality rate, we can measure directly in those parts of the country and the world where there's been a seroprevalence survey. And CDC has been doing serial seroprevalence surveys in about 6 sites. There are other studies. So we've taken all those 200 seroprevalence studies that are available to us and then compared deaths to seroprevalence, and we get a direct measure of the infection fatality rate. That's incredibly related to age. You know, there's 1 in 10 or 20,000 risk of death at age 10. There's 1 out of 6 risk of death at age 85 if you get infected, but we can't find any evidence that the infection fatality rate is changing over time. So that's bad news in terms of the actual population level effect of treatment. But of course, there's a bunch of products going into phase 2 trials, hopefully phase 3 soon, that could really change that story. But our models do not take a breakthrough treatment into account yet. Now, there's a lot of discussion, I know from friends on Wall Street, about herd immunity. And there's some really crazy videos online from people who pretend to be scientists arguing that most of Europe and the US has reached the level of herd immunity. That's the level of infection, cumulative infection, where transmission is no longer going to occur because there's not enough susceptibles coming in contact with each person that's infected to keep the chain of transmission going. And the claim that's out there is that because of other coronaviruses like the common cold, that 80% of the country is immune. Well, we know that's absolutely not true, at least in Europe, because of this natural experiment where a French aircraft carrier basically got totally infected. They didn't intervene, and you ended up with 70% of a young, healthy population getting infected. So clearly not high levels of background immunity. 70% is about what you'd expect with almost no immunity. We already see high levels of cumulative infection in badly hit places that are pretty high, like New Jersey at 25%, Mexico City and Ecuador over 40%. So we know that at least in those settings, there isn't enough background immunity that it'll kick in at those levels. So the level at which we will go to get herd immunity of infection has got to be higher than that. So at best, we think it'll be 40%, more likely 50%. I'll come to that in a moment. So then if not herd immunity, how do we explain the peaks in Europe and in New York and elsewhere? Well, very simply, it was the mandates working. And we don't need to invoke, herd immunity occurring at very low levels to explain those peaks. Now, here's the map of global cumulative infections to date. And it's just showing you the parts of the world in orange and red, which have already seen 25%+ infected. So parts of Mexico, and then a slice in Latin America from Peru, and Ecuador, and parts of northwestern Brazil are the examples at high levels. And then New Jersey, which is hard to see on this map. So when can we expect to see herd immunity and why does it matter? Well, it matters because it gives you a sense of what's going to happen in the long run. Because the thing we know about infectious diseases is they just keep going and transmitting, even if they come in waves, until you get to herd immunity. And you either get to herd immunity because everybody got infected up to that level, or because they get vaccinated. So there's only really two routes to get them there. And I think there's lots of interesting arguments that suggest that the original claims that, you know, 70, 80, 90% would get infected won't be true at the population level. These idea of super spreaders that, you know, they transmit more than half of the cases. And once they're infected, then you break some of those interactions. There's non-random mixing. If you're out in Montana, the probability of interacting with somebody else is much lower than if you're in New York. And there probably is some background immunity that we can't fully explain in Southeast Asia, Africa, and Pakistan. And if people are interested, we can talk more about that. So at best, 40% is where we'll see immunity. And these are sobering numbers. So if we don't get a vaccine, or we don't get mass vaccination rapidly next year, the world, even if in an optimistic level of herd immunity, you would expect 10 million deaths in the world and about 800,000 in the US. So without a vaccine, basically it's saying we're only a quarter of the way there. So we may argue about whether the peak is in December or January, but the key point is that the bulk, the majority of the harm that's likely to be coming is actually, still to come. And that's the key point, I think, for the markets. Now, I'm going to stop there. And hopefully that was interesting. I'm sure hopefully I'll trigger a bunch of questions. And Tom, I don't know who's going to be the moderator here.
Dr. Murray, I'll moderate. We've already got some questions here. This was a great presentation. I would say I know for a fact there's going to be really two areas people want further discussion. You know, one is just your confidence level of this rise in deaths over the next few months, because as you know, that would be very negative for people's perception of their own safety, which means the economy would be affected. And then of course, financial markets would be affected. So I think it has a lot of negative implications. And the second is really, really, I think people want you to expand your discussion around the herd immunity, is including some of the topics around T cells. But let's say that I want to start with some of the questions from that have come in, and then to the extent they're not answered, I want to come back to those topics. So there's a lot I'm going to parse through here. So here's a good one to start. It says, please discuss Sweden.
Yeah, that is a great question. And, people love to pick on Sweden and, you know, try to infer things from Sweden. So first of all, I think the thing to recognize in Sweden is they didn't have no mandates. They had travel bans and travel restrictions, but they certainly had less intervention than in other parts of Europe. So the other part to take into account when you're interpreting the results or trying to avoid overinterpreting Sweden is that culturally, we suspect that there is less close contact in Northern Europe than we see in Southern Europe, right? There is a gradient that we can't explain just by mandates and cell phone-based mobility. So there is some other aspect of how close do people come in contact, you know, even the simple things like what is the typical social greeting? Is it kissing on, you know, three cheeks, or is it, you know, a head nod or a handshake? So I think probably rather than comparing Sweden to places like Spain or Italy or Belgium or New York that had really big epidemics, the right thing is to compare Sweden to Finland, Norway, and Denmark. And what we know there is that the epidemic in Sweden was much larger than those countries that their neighbors that put some mandates in place. So I think it is important to recognize that mobility, mask use, the social distancing mandates explain an awful lot, but they certainly don't explain everything. There's still some residual country variation that we assign to sort of other aspects of behavior patterns that we have not got good data on. Now, Facebook has a really interesting effort underway globally where they survey 1 million people in the US and 1 million globally each week with a very detailed symptom and behavior question. And we've been trying to mine that data to see if any of those behavioral variables predict this unexplained component. And unfortunately, we haven't found a lot, right? So there does remain a component that we're not yet, there's an unexplained component in some settings for some of the background variation. Doesn't change, I think, the basic results that we're coming up with. And we try to capture that, as I explained, that exceptionality in our model. So, you know, our forecasts for Sweden are reasonably modest in compared to some other parts in Europe going forward.
Okay, great. I'm kind of combine some of the questions here because we have 30 questions. And the question is, what could you just elaborate? I know you said in passing about the fact that there hasn't been a flu season, or you know that the flu season is going to be mild. And do you think that this, you know, because of, but it has a lot to do with the mandates, do you think that that's going to result in, you know, some overall change in health outcomes? Because as you know, a lot of folks get sick from the flu annually.
Yeah. So let me start with the latter part and then go to the former. So there is in the US and elsewhere a contingent of people that assign all the winter excess mortality, whether it's from heart disease or from road traffic accidents, to flu. And literally these claims of, you know, 60,000 deaths a year due to flu, those are not actually, you know, PCR confirmed flu. Those are a statistical analysis that says all excess deaths in the winter, including road traffic accidents, are flu. We don't believe that. In fact, we've run lots of studies where we try to differentiate winter or temperature from flu, and you can statistically separate them out. You know, in a bad year, directly confirmed flu deaths are about 6,000. That's a bad year, and in a good year, they're 500. So there's put a big question mark as to whether the winter excess in death that we see for heart disease, for pneumonia, for a long list of causes, is actually flu or is it winter, right? And I think that's a very vigorous scientific debate. And I think in the public discussion around flu since COVID, there's been a little bit too much accepting that flu really kills that many people. But regardless, it does fill up hospital beds. And so it's a big issue for hospital beds. So backing into will we have a bad or a good flu season, the evidence so far is from Australia and New Zealand, where there's been almost no flu. Really, really mild season. So is that... because people in Australia and New Zealand have been very compliant with government recommended lockdowns. Although arguably in New Zealand during the winter season, they were through their first lockdown and they were actually back to normal for much of the flu season, still haven't had a bad flu season. So it may be that the restrictions on travel, the change in behavior, people being more cautious will lead to less severe flu season here in the US. Very hard to know for sure. The Seattle flu study, which does, you know, genomic tracking of viruses, is picking up already flu virus. It's circulating, it's out there. So we know the virus is circulating in some US populations, but probably it's not going to be a very severe flu season based on the behavioral patterns that we're seeing right now. But I would put some uncertainty around that.
Got it. Okay, this question comes from Eric, and he says, if we get a vaccine in 4Q, that's 80 to 90% effective. Do you think the mask protocols will continue to be required, or do you believe that COVID will be an annual mutation virus like the flu?
I don't think COVID will be like the flu, right? I don't think we've seen anything yet to suggest that. Didn't happen with SARS-1 or at all. So on that one, I hope we won't see it. If we got a super effective vaccine, I don't think anybody I know in the vaccine business is expecting something that good. And you know, certainly these are the early vaccines are very innovative technology platforms that we have never yet seen be successful. So there's still some doubt about it, but I think most people are hopeful we'll have something. And I don't think even if we get the vaccine, will we have mass production, because the production capabilities for these vaccines are limited. So CEPI, the international group that funds and does a lot of work around coordinating vaccines, their view is middle of next year. So I think the general consensus is that mass vaccination with an impact on community transmission is middle of next year. I think it could be earlier in the US because we probably have some, you know, being more aggressive on negotiating access to some of the early products. But I can't see having enough of the vaccine out there to change these numbers during the period of the winter surge, right? I think it'll start to show up just about when in March we're starting to taper off on that. Now on the mask protocols, you know, masks are pretty non-intrusive in reality and can have a really huge benefit. And so we would be smart to keep trying to promote and push mask use until we really get up to a very high level of vaccine coverage. The other thing just on vaccines, the vaccine hesitancy studies that are out there, you know, the surveys are a little bit worrisome because vaccines have been somewhat politicized. I think that's also gonna like enhance the vaccine hesitancy. So I think many people are expecting that we won't, even if we have the supplies available and we have great delivery mechanisms, we probably will only get to 50% coverage of vaccines, even in a good scenario. So we're thinking that vaccines, if it's 60% effective, 50% coverage, is very akin to mask wearing. So it may be easier to get to that coverage with a vaccine than it is to get, you know, a higher fraction of the US wearing a mask. But
got so. It. Okay. This question's from Brian. It says, can you explain why seasonality plays such a big role in your model? Is it driven by actual seasonality or behavioral changes? Indoor versus outdoor dining things.
So the way we get seasonality, and this is why we fit our model statistically using the whole world and not just, you know, one country at a time, because we need the northern and the southern hemisphere in the model at the same time to get a reasonable estimate of seasonality. And if you think about it, like anecdotally, if you look at the data, the reason the model wants to assign a big coefficient to the pneumonia seasonality variable is you have these huge epidemics in southern Brazil and Chile and Argentina and South Africa playing out in their winter season. And analogous countries, you know, and they didn't, the epidemic was very slow to get going in those places, you know, back in the spring or their fall. And analogous places in Europe and northern states in the U.S. In the time of the summer, big exception for Florida, Texas, Arizona, California, were having higher levels of mobility, lower levels of mask use, and not much happening. So the model sees that and says that the seasonality has to account for that. And that's where we get a big estimate of the coefficient on that pneumonia seasonality variable. Now, you know, there's no reason. It's just a covariate, right? And so our estimate of seasonality is data-driven in that sense. It is very large, right? We're saying that COVID will be as seasonal as pneumonia, not implausible, given most pneumonia, or a lot of pneumonia, not most, but a lot of pneumonia is viral. So, you know, it has some biological validity because it's grounded in what happens to the collectivity of other respiratory pathogens, and it's empirically driven. So, you know, I think it's super important to recognize that we're not imposing any assumption about seasonality. We're just letting the data drive that estimate.
Okay. All right. Now, we've got so many questions. We have 51. So I'm gonna combine a few because there seems to be a lot of questions about herd immunity. And I know you made a really interesting comment about some regions like Asia, Sub-Saharan, have some immunity. I guess if you could speak to the origin of that, is that because of malaria or some other thing? And I have a follow-up to that.
Yeah, now, you know, this is one of the absolute mysteries that nobody can really sort of say with clarity what's going on. So as early as March, there were claims that by the end of the year, there would be 10 million deaths in Africa from COVID. And those claims were grounded on the idea that, you know, COVID would spread through everywhere. And that even though they had a young population, so that their infection fatality rate on average will be lower, because, you know, we know it's so age related, that comorbidities are very high, and HIV and other immune suppression, malaria, would cause them to have higher death rates. The opposite has occurred. We have seen no major epidemics except South Africa in Africa. And even as recently as the last 2-3 weeks, we've seen Kenya and Ethiopia go up. And then people said, aha, it's finally coming. And they hit a peak and now it's going away. And the prevailing view when people have started to go do some seroprevalence surveys is that you have quite high infection rates in Kenya, in Nigeria, and a few other places that have been measured. So the general idea is that, you know, the young population, so lots of younger people getting infected, not many deaths, but that's still not enough to account for what we're seeing. And so people have said there has to be, and it's just an argument by residual. Given we're seeing these peaks and declines, they're not, and this is during mandate easing in Kenya and Ethiopia and elsewhere, there has to be some other factor. And so the idea is that about half of the population, you know, playing with some models, might have some background residual immunity. Nobody knows why. In Southeast Asia, there's a theory that's common amongst immunologists that there's a lot of bats and that there has been residual exposure to bat coronaviruses in those parts of the world. And that might account for why, you know, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand had really low levels. And then the one that's the other mystery, and the contrast is so marked, is Pakistan versus India. India has this roaring epidemic, just keeps going up. And earlier on, you know, the epidemic started earlier in Pakistan. Everybody thought it was going to be an enormous death toll because of population density and, you know, poverty and not great access to healthcare. It hit a peak and has just been going away. And again, lots of theories that it's got to be some background immunity, even arguments that it's polio vaccine, that's a popular one. There was a big, strong argument it was BCG vaccine that was giving them this immunity. No clarity on the source, but it's very hard to account for what we've observed in those regions without resorting to something like that.
Okay. Great. I'm going to switch to a question from John, who says, given how harsh you think the death rate will be this winter, what does this imply in terms of distribution of deaths by age? Presumably younger people will have greater survival rates and perhaps the more vulnerable have already passed away.
Yeah, this is the Deadwood argument that's out there. And in fact, you know, there's been all sorts of variants of this argument. The reason we don't think that that's, this is why I think watching what's happening in Madrid is so interesting, because Spain and Madrid in particular had one of the worst epidemics. And yet now, sort of just like clockwork, we're seeing the fall surge. And we're seeing, again, about a month after cases start surging, deaths have started to go up, hospitalizations going up, as I showed earlier on. So while there's, you know, some plausibility that, especially in nursing homes, where we weren't watching in this country, and in same in some parts of Europe, I think we'll avoid the, by screening and testing, the sort of the virus ripping through frail people in nursing homes. I don't think we will avoid it going through the more general public. And certainly the death rates seen in some of the nursing homes were really high. But one thing we know from all the data around the world is just how age-related the infection fatality rate is. You know, we're talking about the difference, almost three orders of magnitude difference between the lowest rates for 10-year-olds and the highest rates in the 90s. So enormous variation, but there's plenty of people at risk there for there to be a considerable death toll.
Okay. This is actually related. This question comes from Jeff, and his question is, will rapid testing, so I'm going to actually reframe the question. It says, could rapid testing change outcomes, making it easy to identify the infected? I guess really it's a good question. It's like, question is, you know, masks are, and mandates are one effect on the model. Would better testing and contact tracing affect the path? You know, like how does that affect sort of that path?
So, you know, clearly a country like New Zealand has shown that testing, aggressive contact tracing, aggressive quarantine, when you have the epidemic at a very early level, can work. And they've shown it to work twice, right? They had this, the spring outbreak, and then they, you know, relaxed their guard on the border. They had a breakthrough transmission, and now they've brought Auckland back under control, it seems. And that's very much a testing tracing strategy. It works when you have a handful of cases, right? And you can throw a lot of resources at tracing, tracking down contacts, getting their contacts. You get test results quickly, or pending test results, you get people in quarantine. So that can work. And the reason we have testing in our model as a covariate, testing per capita, is that back in April, we assumed this would be a core strategy. We thought the US would follow the New Zealand and Australia model of keeping lockdown in place until the burden of infection got to a very low level. And then it's all about testing and contact tracing for control. And that definitely can work as a strategy. That cannot work when you have thousands of cases in a community and you have to trace tens of thousands, because nobody has that capability as demonstrated as yet. And so right now, statistically in our model, in April, because you had the early places, the Koreas, the Singapores, the New Zealands, the Australias, doing the testing, getting it under control, the coefficient on testing was really strongly negative, like incredibly so. The coefficient has just been steadily heading towards zero, so that we have barely any protective effect of testing in the model right now. And it makes sense, because right now, so many of the tests that are being done, people don't get the result for 3, 4, 5, 6 days. The period of infectiousness is about 3 to 5 days. So if you show up, get tested, and you get the result after your infectiousness is over, it has absolutely no effect. And most jurisdictions are not really capable right now of doing contact tracing and testing. If we were going to have a period when that was going to have an effect, it would have had to have been, you know, at the lowest point. And we just haven't seen states in this country really step up on that regard. The other problem we have is data, which is states are not telling us about contact tracing. They're not reporting numbers of people who are being contacted. So we can't separately stick in the model, which is what we'd like, the number of people being contact traced, because you know the volume, most of the testing is still going to symptomatics.
Got it. Are you okay if we kind of speak about some questions outside your model in sure. about science?
Yeah.
Okay. Because there were several questions, and I'm going to kind of group them. But the first one relates to some treatments that have kind of lost their sort of standing in the U.S. because of some political development, you know, politicization of this. You know, one is blood plasma, and we had another question about hydroxychloroquine. I mean, could you just give your thoughts on, you know, sure. on those treatments?
Yeah, and I'm probably no better informed than many people on the call on both fronts. I have not seen yet, you know, anything that's particularly convincing on either front. The available published studies, as everyone knows, are not very encouraging on that front. So not a whole lot of enthusiasm, I think, in the infectious disease world that those were breakthroughs. Doesn't mean that they won't be, because it may be that they were tried on the wrong subset of patients. But so far, no prospect there that those are going to be the breakthroughs. I've heard much more encouraging early signs from some of the new generation of antivirals. And of course, there's a lot of enthusiasm about monoclonals that might come along.
Got it. Now, this is a question about one of your charts, which I think is the one that's currently on screen. It says, why isn't the African continent seeing a high infection rate? And I think the implicit question is because, as you know, in the U.S., Blacks have disproportionately represented a higher level of infection in the U.S. So I guess they may be asking why in the U.S. it's much higher than it is in Africa.
Sure. And so let's start with the U.S. The reason that we see, you know, about a relative risk for both cases and deaths for Hispanics and for Blacks in this country is about 3 compared to white non-Hispanics. So, you know, it varies a lot by state. Some states, there isn't a difference. The prevailing theory for that is that they make up the essential workforce. And so they are much more likely to be exposed. They weren't able to self-isolate at home and work from home. And so they're just getting more exposure. The available studies in the US don't show a difference in the death rate once you get to hospital for these groups. So it doesn't seem to be, which is one of the concerns, you know, they're getting lower quality care. That it seems to be mostly about transmission. And it could also just be living in more dense, lower quality housing, much greater probability of transmission in addition to being essential workers. In sub-Saharan Africa, you know, the numbers could be higher, but you know, to date, there's been so little death in Africa, and we have, you know, the question about cases and deaths being so low, is it that they're missing a lot of transmission, and they just don't have the tests, and therefore the data that's being reported is underestimating. So there's probably some truth in that. That's what some of these more detailed studies in Kenya have been arguing. But so far, you know, we don't have much evidence to say there's a big epidemic underway in Africa. And it's back to this various hypotheses about why. And, you know, one of them is about background immunity. That background immunity would not be genetic, so there'd be no reason it would relate to Blacks in this country. It would be exposure to other viruses that... you know, and pathogens. And then maybe these theories that are out there, for which there's now a clinical trial, that polio vaccine has been played some a role in that.
Got it. Okay. Here's a prescriptive question. And I'm going to rephrase their question, but it says, you know, is the US government's response unjustly criticized? And I don't think that's really what we'd want you to answer. I think the question we want you to answer is, your forecast is essentially looking at a massive wave of deaths coming in the next few months. So it's almost like a redo, because we're almost where we were in January, where we have a chance to prepare or do something in front of a wave of cases. So what would you prescribe to governments and to individuals if you were going to dispense advice that 100% they had to accept?
We end up in these conversations with state governments and the White House and other governments quite a lot. Not the 100% they have to follow what we say part, though. So, what will be different this time around? First of all, hospitals are not going to be caught off guard. So despite the populist view that somehow the epidemic's over, no hospital administrator that I know is taking that seriously. And at the very least, they're taking the risk that there will be a huge surge very seriously. So we will not have anywhere near the shortages of PPE and ventilators that we plagued the response in March and April. So that's a big plus. And I think hospitals have been developing their strategies for staffing and surge capacity. And what we learned in the spring is that hospitals can increase bed capacity by about 60% on average. And so they can scale up when needed. You know, that means putting beds in the hallway and moving ventilators around, et cetera. So that'll be a big difference. I think FEMA and DOD are way more prepared to move resources around the country as needed. And they're scanning and they're constantly looking where the next hotspot will be, so that, you know, those types of shortages won't occur. So that's good news. The other thing that's, such a simple thing to do, should be done at the federal level and the state level, because it doesn't really impede the economy with a few exceptions, like, you know, indoor dining, is a mask mandate. You know, we should have a mask mandate everywhere with penalties. We know that penalties work. They raise the coverage of masks by about 15 percentage points. So that's a really easy choice to make, and seems to just have gotten caught up in some political issues for no obvious reason. There's not an economic health trade-off there. The big problem will come whether or not states will want to or need to reimpose some types of mandates when things get worse. My guess is those places where kids are in school will relatively quickly shut school. Is that November 1st or is that December 1st? I don't know, but it'll be sometime in that time frame, in the northern states at least. And then the question will be, what other mandates? And I get this question from governors and others all the time, which is there lockdown light that will help stop the hospitals being overwhelmed if it comes to that without totally impeding economic activity? Is that closing bars, restaurants, you know, theaters, and having no gatherings more than 10? And that's really what we need to figure out. And unfortunately, the data is out there because there's been this huge natural experiment. Every municipality, every county has done their own thing to some extent. And if we had a big database of when they put all those different mandates in place, we could run the models and extract which, at a more nuanced level, is it indoor dining? Is it, 50% capacity? Is it 30%? Is it anything? All those sort of more nuance, so that we can be much more nuanced about the policy response. That data is not publicly available, unfortunately, in a easy place to get, and the government hasn't been releasing, the detailed data that we need to be able to do that analysis yet. Hopefully they'll change their mind as they recognize we need to figure this out collectively. But yeah, those would be the things I would
think
part of the response.
Great. Dr. Murray, we've actually just passed 1 hour with your time. So I was hoping to kind of just conclude with, listen, I think there's gonna be a lot of people that want to follow up with you. So do you mind giving some either something you're comfortable sharing, whether it's your Twitter or a general email account, or of course, anyone who wants to follow up can contact us and we will of course forward anything. But if there's any final contact info you want to share.
Yeah, I put it up on the last slide here, and either Charles Johnscher or Bill Heisel, and there's their email, would be a good port of call. But you know, reach out through you guys as well. I mean, we're very happy to open up further discussions about this.
Great. Well, I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I know it's tough on a Friday, especially on a quadruple expiry day, but thank you for tuning in. I found this really great. So I want to thank you for taking the time.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Glad you're interested. Thanks.
Thanks.